This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
The war in Gaza always had the capacity to spread. Sporadic rocket attacks on northern Israel by Hamas's Lebanese allies Hezbollah have displaced 60,000 Israeli citizens close to the border. Until recently, the smart money was on both sides, Israel and Hezbollah, avoiding full-out escalation. That money isn't looking so smart today. Last week's extraordinary targeting of thousands of Hezbollah operatives through their pagers and walkie-talkies seems to have altered the calculus. How did Israel carry out this operation, and why now? What does it say about how modern wars are conducted, and what can we expect to happen in the weeks to come? Step inside the briefing room, and together we'll find out. To help me understand all this, I'm joined by Shashank Joshi, the Economist defence editor, Professor Lina Khatib, director of the Middle East Institute at SOAS University of London, and Ronan Bergman, Israeli investigative journalist and author of Rise and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations. Lina Khatib, let's start with the question that you probably always get asked. Who are Hezbollah and where did they come from?
Hezbollah are an armed group in Lebanon. They first came into existence in the early 80s when Israel started occupying southern Lebanon. They presented themselves as a resistance group against Israel. And even though Israel withdrew from Lebanon in 2000, the group kept its weapons and continued to present itself as a necessary force for the defense of Lebanon and became the country's most powerful political actor at the same time.
Do they represent any particular religious group in Lebanon?
Hezbollah come from the Shia community in Lebanon, which is about a third of the population. This community used to be very disadvantaged at the time of Hezbollah's emergence, meaning socially, at the development level, economically. And so Hezbollah took advantage of that to present itself as the voice of the Shia community. And of course, it did so with the backing of Iran, because all this happened just after the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And this was also part of Iran's increasing influence in the Middle East.
Right, and to remind us very crudely, Iran is also a Shia power, so there's also there's a very big kind of religious crossover. What political power do they have in Lebanon?
Hezbollah are actually represented in the government in Lebanon. In the beginning, they were very antagonistic towards the Lebanese state, but became more pragmatic with time and realized that actually becoming a political actor would enable them to have more power. And they used their possession of weapons to intimidate their political opponents in Lebanon. So they actually have been implicated in the assassination, for example, of one of Lebanon's former prime ministers, Rafiq Hariri, who was killed in 2005. And today they are very powerful. They have representation across the government, in parliament, in the cabinet, and they also have veto power in the cabinet. So they are, in a way, controlling the Lebanese state behind the scenes.
Well, that partially gives an answer to my next question, which is why the Lebanese government allows an armed group to attack its neighbours with rockets about a dispute in which Lebanon is not formally involved.
This is why I characterize Hezbollah as controlling Lebanon behind the scenes, because although it has official representation, real power comes through Hezbollah's intimidation, because it's the only armed group in Lebanon other than the Lebanese army. And in fact, many analysts say that it is more powerful than the Lebanese army, and it has used these weapons to intimidate its opponents. And therefore, it is able to set the foreign policy agenda for Lebanon to a large extent, as well as declare war basically on behalf of Lebanon without the Lebanese state being in acquiescence or even without seeking authorization from the Lebanese authorities. So it's a de facto controller of Lebanon.
Shashank, what is their relationship with Iran in terms of weaponry and in terms of command structures?
Iran is the principal armourer of Hezbollah and has been since the group's foundation. That includes rockets, drones, more advanced missiles. And whilst it can produce some of these domestically inside Lebanon, what comes from Iran is the really important bit, which is the guidance kits, which are the bits that go on top of old-fashioned dumb missiles and make them GPS-guided and therefore make them very accurate and far more dangerous. In terms of command structure, Hezbollah doesn't simply do anything Iran wants. It has some domestic agency. But the expectation has always been that if Iran came under serious attack, say from America or Israel over its nuclear program, that Hezbollah would be one of the most important defensive assets, or retaliatory assets to be more precise, that Iran would have. So there isn't simply a sort of immediate direct command, but they are very, very closely tied in aims and in practices.
Brendan Bergman, we'll talk a bit more about the pager and walkie-talkie attacks in a moment. But could you just tell us, explain to the listener exactly who Mossad are, because they've been cited quite widely with regard to this, a little bit about what their remit is and what their modus operandi tends to be?
Yes. Mossad is the translation from Hebrew. Oh, the word in Hebrew for the Institute. It's not an acronym. It's the Institute. The full name is the Institute for Intelligence and Special Operations. This is the Foreign Intelligence Service Agency of Israel. It's somewhat equivalent to the MI6, the French DGSE, or the CIA. But unlike many of the intelligence services, unlike the BND, for example, Mossad is not just about collection of intelligence, but as in its full name, it's about special operations. So the Mossad will collect intelligence, but also sees as its duty to take action and facilitate, translate the intelligence it collects into what they call kinetic or aggressive or physical operations way beyond enemy lines to stop what Israel sees as national security threat, bad intentions from Israel folks. And so from almost day one, Mossad was trying to infiltrate the enemy ranks, but also was building itself in order to be able to perform high-risk operation way beyond enemy lines, explosions, sabotage, and what is, you know, Mossad is well known of, targeted killings.
Ronan, thank you. Shashank Joshi, it's nearly a week now since the pager attack in Lebanon. And after that, the day after the walkie-talkies were targeted, what do we now know about these attacks?
We don't know anything with complete certainty. I've got to emphasise that. But what we know from the reporting that has emerged, including that of Ronan and my colleagues and others, is that this looks to have been a supply chain attack. That is to say, Mossad infiltrated the supply chain for pagers by setting up front companies that looks as though they manufactured real pagers for some time. And when it came to this consignment that was bound for Hezbollah, it seems that they placed explosives into the devices that they were then subsequently able to remotely trigger. There are some accounts that suggest Mossad knew where these pagers were, who was in possession of them, and was able to specifically detonate them. I'm a little bit skeptical of that account. But this was not, and here I really have to emphasize this, this was not some magical cyber attack in which the batteries spontaneously combusted by some clever bit of code, as people may initially have thought or suspected.
Ronan, do we know anything about who actually was the mastermind behind these pager and walkie-talkie attacks?
So the walkie-talkie operation preceded the pagers. The pagers were born from the obsession of Nasrallah and other leaders that were very concerned of the use of cell phones by Hezbollah operatives, and they deemed the pagers as much, much safer. And they were safer. And then in 2018, a young intelligence officer came with the idea and basically said, if Nasrallah is moving to pages, why don't the intelligence agencies following Nasrallah will move to pages as well? It started with the surveillance of the content of the text that these pages are receiving. And it developed into a full-scale booby-trapped 4,500 pages that were supplied to Hezbollah.
The important thing here is there are many cases in intelligence history where spy agencies have infiltrated kit at scale in the supply chain. Almost always that has been to put in eavesdropping devices. There are also cases where spy agencies, including Mossad in the 90s, have put a bomb into someone's phone, but in a specific isolated targeted case. I've never seen or heard of a case where those two elements, so massive supply chain infiltration plus the infiltration of explosives, booby traps, have been done combined at scale. That is what the remarkable thing about last week was.
Roman Bergman, the rubric that we're supposed to use when we discuss this attack is that Israel is believed to have carried out these attacks because Israel never confirms that it does. Why doesn't it confirm it when everybody knows that Israel did it? What's the reason for that?
Well, Israel has a long-term policy of not denying, not confirming, because if, according to their perception, if they deny a specific case or confirm a specific other case, this will show on other cases which they don't want to comment on. Also, I would say sort of rule is that when it's about operations in the West Bank or in Gaza, then this is like a close hemisphere in Israel takes responsibility. When it's about Lebanon or Iran, then Israel leave it in a sort of thin air. But also sometimes Israeli politicians with wink and nod, they give the confirmation. Following on what Shashan just said before me, I think we have not seen cases like that because this case, this modus operandi, which in Israel is called the buttons, so massive infiltration into the core infrastructure, network communication of the enemy, they are left for cases of extreme situation, last resort, Armageddon war. And the fact that we did not see things happening in this scale until now is not because they did not exist, but because Israel never pushed the button. And the button that was pushed now, two buttons, so the wireless, the walkie-talkie, and the pagers, there are a lot of people in the defense establishment who are ballistic because they said this was not supposed to be pushed here. And now this was part of a very different strategy. And that strategy, now pushing it now, served some kind of political agenda, not just defensive agenda.
That's very interesting. And I want to come on to more of that a bit in a moment, precisely. Lina, we saw pictures of these pages going off in marketplaces and other places where they had CCTV. What did the result of the attack tell us about Hezbollah's organization and structure?
We already knew a lot about Hezbollah's organization and structure in the sense that this is a group that operates with a high degree of secrecy. So not all its members are known, sometimes even to their own families. And what these devices did was expose who is actually a paid member of Hezbollah. These pagers were not distributed to just any members. They were distributed to those who are paid by Hezbollah to perform quite key roles. These roles could be combatant or non-combatant roles. So they were revealed through this. Of course, a lot of intelligence has been gathered as a result of this revelation. In fact, one of the people who ended up in hospital was later visited by someone, and that person, the visitor, was later tracked by Israel, leading them to find out where the leaders of Hezbollah were meeting on the Friday that came after the attack, and that helped the targeting of those commanders through an Israeli strike. And so, in a way, Israel achieved quite a bit about revealing who the people in Hezbollah are, where they are, and also, of course, you know, using through this as part of the threat to reach the higher level command.
Shashank, is this a new kind of warfare or is it a one-off? I mean, will everybody now know that people are capable of doing this and therefore prevent it?
It's always been possible, if you wanted, to put explosives as a spy agency inside a phone, a pager, inside a banana, if you feel like it. The point is, to what end? And of course, the point here isn't the ability to smuggle in explosives. It's the ability to identify a specific batch that is bound for a group you were trying to penetrate. We know, I think the Americans contemplated operations like this, but they shied away because they were concerned about the overall effect. My suggestion is that we're not going to see many attacks like this. You'll be able to detect the explosives. Agencies, groups will be taking apart devices to check them more carefully. And it takes a hell of a lot of resources to build the kind of front companies years in advance that Israel will have done that isn't in the hands of most groups or countries.
Well, that's very interesting, because that gives emphasis to what you were saying, Ronan, which is that this is a kind of one-off. It was a use it or lose it situation. Once you've done it, you can't do it again.
Unless the buttons are hidden somewhere else and not in the wireless. Look, Hezbollah is designated a terrorist organization by most countries and organizations in the West. It's very hard for Hezbollah or Hezbollah operatives to import any kind of goods into Lebanon. They need to use middlemen. They need to use illegal trade lines for practically everything. And that everything relates to basically each item they use. And if they don't, then it means that this also sabotage their operations. Now, the case that Lina just spoke about, Israel was following on someone who went to visit someone at the hospital, and that helped tracing down into where Ibrahim Akil, the head of operation for Hezbollah, was having a meeting with the leaders of the front Radwan force, enabling Israel to kill them all. I think what we see, and this is also very evident in the bombings that are taking place in this very hour in Lebanon, on specific storage of long-range ballistic surface-to-surface or surface missiles, it's the intelligence infiltration of Israel into the rank of Hezbollah. We have written a few times that Israel is much more updated about Hezbollah than it was about Hamas, which is evident, of course, about the surprise event of October 7th. And I think it's clear that Israel was waiting and preparing for this day. And what we see is a series of attacks that were planned long ago and are aimed at dismantling, as much as they will not be able to dismantle everything, of course, Hezbollah is much stronger than that, but dismantling as much as they can from Hezbollah force to attack Israel.
Yeah, and that random... This morning, as you were suggesting, the IDF warned villagers in South Lebanon, where they thought they might be living next to Hezbollah weapons, to evacuate. And those, presumably, those strikes have already begun. What do you think, Shashank, is coming?
I think that there is a growing risk of an Israeli ground invasion of southern Lebanon. It isn't imminent. All of our indications are that the IDF, the Israel Defense Force, is not quite ready yet. But it's becoming increasingly difficult, David, to tell the difference between Israel's coercive campaign to say we will keep inflicting pain on you through airstrikes and these kind of covert attacks until you get away from the border and move north, move your forces away from our border so we can get our residents back into northern Israel, between that and preparations for a ground offensive, which look like they are not quite there yet, but could be coming over the horizon. If you look at Israel softening up Hezbollah arms depots in these strikes, taking out the leadership, these are all the kinds of things you would need to be doing ahead of a major ground campaign inside Lebanon.
Lina, we've been here before, haven't we?
It would be, in my view, completely foolish of Israel to invade Lebanon by ground. They have been there before. Hezbollah in the 80s and 90s was nowhere near as armed and sophisticated in its arsenal as it is today. And it has long experience in ground warfare. And so actually Hezbollah welcomes the kind of asymmetrical warfare that would happen if Israel does invade. And so I think Israel will continue to have the upper hand if it does not invade. The invasion is a scenario Hezbollah actually is entering anticipating, has been preparing for decades.
Ronan Bowman, this is a very interesting juncture. So let's go step back a moment and ask ourselves, what was Israel's thinking in starting this new phase with the pager attacks? I mean, we have generally been advised that Israel was avoiding full-blown conflict with Hezbollah, didn't want war on two fronts. Has that effectively changed?
To some extent, it did, but not to the extent of, and here I'm in full agreement with Lina, to do something that would be very foolish from the Israeli point of view, and this is a ground invasion into Lebanon. There is one important member of the Supreme Command of the military who is in favor of that, but all the other generals, including the chief of staff and the chief of the Air Force, they're all against it because they understand, they remember the 80s and the 90s, and then remember the Israeli gloomy attempt to invade Lebanon in 2006, and they understand this could be a death trap. What Israel is trying to do is to convince Secretary General Nasrallah to sign an agreement without Israel ending the war in the south with Hamas. Mr. Nasrallah has promised a few times, even after the Pages attack, that he will not surrender, that he will not end his solidarity with Hamas, that he will not go to any kind of political solution as the American mediator Amos Hochstein is proposing until Israel ends its war with Hamas. Prime Minister Netanyahu, for his coalition integrity, doesn't want to end the war with Hamas, doesn't want to sign an agreement on the hostages because he fears this will bring the inquiry committee after the war, possible elections, and he puts the future of his political career above everything else, including the fate of the hostages, unfortunately. So Israel was trying to sort of arrange the situation from the beginning and say, while Israel does not end the war in the south, they will coerce Secretary General Nasrallah to agree to a ceasefire in the north. Now, of course, the risk of this is that it will lead to the other way. It will lead, instead of ceasefire and a political solution, it will lead to an all-out war.
Lina, Mojtaba Amani, Iran's ambassador to Lebanon, was actually injured in the pager attack, meaning he had a Hezbollah page on him. What do you think Iran will be urging Hezbollah to do?
Ultimately, the aim now for Iran and Hezbollah, and in fact all the other Iran-backed groups in the region, is self-preservation. What Hezbollah is trying to do is ride this wave and emerge triumphant one way or another with its face saved, meaning it is trying to do the minimum to retain credibility as a so-called resistance actor. This is what it calls itself. It is part of the network of groups supported by Iran in the region. All of them say they are there to support Palestine, even though in reality they actually don't really do much about Palestine. So for Hezbollah right now, the priority is to just survive. And that means it's not going to launch all-out war against Israel. It's not in its interest to do so. But it will have to, I think, continue its rocket attacks on Israel so as to save face, because it can't be seen as backing down, can't be seen as letting down its ally Hamas in Gaza, even if Hezbollah's participation really has been mainly symbolic when it comes to Hamas support.
Ronan Bowman, I mean, there's the danger for you, which is that Israel's effectively now said, you're lobbing rockets over at us, which has forced us to evacuate 60,000 people from northern Israel, is not tolerable. And yet we've heard from Lina that that is still the way in which Hezbollah will try to respond to the situation with Israel. So I'm bound to ask, does the situation with Hezbollah still depend on the war in Gaza, or is it actually a war of its own?
Well, I think there's still some debate among Israeli military intelligence and political leaders. What's the goal? What's the strategy? And I'm not sure that Israel has a strategy beyond the ability to explode those walkie-talkie or pagers in the thousands. We have to bear in mind that Nasrallah ordered Hezbollah to attack Israel on October 8, one day after Hamas attacked Israel, and launched a massive year-long unprovoked attack, saying publicly that this is his solidarity with the the Palestinian people and with Hamas. Israel has warned many times that it will react with massive force. Throughout the year, they exchanged blows from side to side. I think that it showed that for a very long time, both sides did not want to deteriorate into a full-scale war. And it seems that Israel has reached that critical mass, that Israel has decided that's enough. And now Israel has changed the rules and it's taking the risk of deterioration, but it decided that bring back those between 60 and 100,000 refugees back to where they live safely, they deem that more important, even with the risk of deterioration.
Shashank Joshi, there have been, obviously, both sides rattle sabers and so on, but an Israeli education minister is quoted recently, this week, in the last few days, as having said that one objective could be to dismantle and annihilate Lebanon. Is this just kind of mad talk?
I've heard many senior Israeli officials say that in a war with Hezbollah, Israel would target Lebanese state infrastructure. And the idea is that the entire state has to feel some pain in order for Hezbollah to back down. And that would include targets that Israel sees as dual use, like the airport, the port, the electricity grid, the power grid. So we would undoubtedly see Israeli attacks on state infrastructure as a means of pressuring Hezbollah. That is inevitable.
So look, first of all, this is an ultra-right extreme government with some of the government ministers, you know, I would say competing each other on who would make a more extreme and baseless and aggressive remark on the enemy, whoever the enemy is.
But it isn't just far-right ministers who want to target Lebanese state infrastructure. That is a wider point of consensus, I'd say.
I agree. Because what the government, and this is also about the military, what they are trying to do is to say it cannot be that we, meaning Israel, are fighting a terrorist organization or militia, and the militia, it's controlling a country, as was explained here before, but we cannot fight a country, and it puts Israel into an inferiority. And in order to get some more pressure done from the Lebanese country as much as it matters, and I believe that Secretary General Nasrallah is a Lebanese patriot. He's not just a Shiite, he's not just a Hezbollah member, he's not just a proxy of Iran. He's a Lebanese patriot according to his perception, and the hope in Israel is that if the Lebanese country pays the price, he will care. We'll see.
Lina Khatib, if you had relatives in northern Israel and in southern Lebanon, would you be advising them to leave home and get out of there now?
I think a lot of people have already done that, and more people are doing that. The people who have remained are the people who probably don't have the means to flee. And I think it's unfortunate that the civilian price has been so high on both sides in this equation. But certainly things don't seem to be calming down anytime soon.
Nina Khatib there with Shashank Joshi and Ronan Bergman. And just before we go, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the ones about the risk of escalation in other parts of the world, Russia and the South China Sea. The Briefing Room will be back in November. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Natasha Fernandes and Ben Carter. The editor was Richard Varden, and the sound engineer was Neil Churchill.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside.
In order to understand the deep state, you must understand the organizations within the deep state.
As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, where the storming of the Capitol was a setup and the institutions of the state are a facade.
It's all an illusion.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.